I'm Susan Lubbe for Women's Focus.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ludke.
Well, I'm really interested in the book that you've been working on with your daughter about adopting Chinese daughters. But I'm very excited about the new one that you're going to be working on, that going back into your history, because I remember so vividly how important it was and how difficult it was for women to get into the locker room and how that was treated also. So just tell me a little bit about what you're feeling as you look back at your former life.
Well, my former life, interestingly, was well documented, because the idea of women wanting to go into a Major League Baseball locker room caught the attention of not only the American public, but really a global interest in it. And I'll tell you why. I mean, there were three elements that still to this day we refer to now as clickbait. And that is the potential of women intersecting with naked men. The idea of women barging into a place where the dominant culture at the time, the men, would say they didn't belong. And the last part of it really was that I was taking on a bastion of male privilege, really one of the last by that point. I mean, there were a few men's clubs that still were sort of facing the eventuality that they would need to change their practices. But baseball was the national pastime, and it really was a bastion of male privilege. And so this was a very compelling story on so many different levels that it really had the capacity to continue generating headlines almost for a year. Yeah.
One thing I was interested in was to find out that this isn't something that you were planning to take on, that you really had a love of baseball and that you had an interest in it, and that's why you got involved in it.
Yeah, I really was drawn to covering the sport and really working hard to get that appointment or assignment to the beat at Sports Illustrated, where I was working. Not because I had any grand plan that I wanted to be kind of a token or a symbol of the women's movement in taking this on. I took it on because I simply love the sport, and I felt it would be an enormous challenge to become a reporter of the sport, not a woman reporter. I saw myself as just becoming a reporter. But as I went up and started attending games, it soon dawned on me that I was the woman reporter. And I began to understand how much it was dominated by the men-only mentality that I had only known about a little bit through history. Because before I started in the mid-70s, there was a history associated with women trying to cover baseball on a very occasional basis. They would be sent for a feature story or go up to cover a series or games, or be sent by their editor on the road to cover like a series. The Cleveland Indians sent a woman named Doris O'Donnell in the 50s. And, you know, when I learned about her story, I learned that she was not allowed to even go on the field before the game where they're taking batting practice. And then I began to hear about Diane Shaw in the early 70s. She was again sent by her magazine to do a cover a series in Fenway Park. And when she got there, first of all, she was told that she wasn't going to be able to go on the field, and she was told she wouldn't sit in the press box. And she only got those rights when she got a male editor and a male attorney from her publication to get on the phone and be sure that when she arrived at Fenway Park, she was treated equally in those aspects. But she never imagined that she actually had to request that she would be able to eat with the other sports writers before the game. And so she arrived, and she thought everything was taken care of, you know, by the lawyer and her editor. And she was walked upstairs, and she got to the entrance to the place where everyone has their kind of pregame meal. That's part of the tradition. The home team kind of feeds the sports writers. And they told her no, she couldn't go in there. She was a woman. They were men. That was off limits. And they had a little picnic table set up with a sign on it saying Ladies Pavilion. And she was supposed to sit on the roof by herself and eat her meal. And this was also how it was done with a woman named Anita Martini down at the Houston Astros. They would, again, deliver her food to her on a tray, and they would joke that this was like the hotel service that she could expect in Paris, you know, and she ought to be grateful for it. So I knew a bit of this history, but by the time I got up there, you know, you always think things will be solved by the time you get there. And I realized they were far from solved. I mean, I could go on the field and I sat in the press box. So those things were resolved. I did eat with the sports writers before. But so locker room access, or what I would call equal access to be able to do my job fully, which was to interview the athletes before and after the game, I was cut off from that. So it really was the last bastion for baseball to show its desire to keep women out of this profession. And there were the older reporters and the older PR guys who had been around the sport forever who viewed the arrival of one woman as sort of a preview of coming attractions, you know, that there would be 50 women coming the next day. One of the PR people said to Diane Shaw, the older guy, up Bill Crowley up at the Red Sox, when Diane finally got in the next day to eat with the men because Tom Yawkey, the owner, found out about it and invited her to go in and eat with him. So that was taken care of. So she went up to introduce herself to Bill Crowley, and she basically said, "Hi, I'm Diane Shaw." He was the one who tried to keep her out. And she said, "You see, it's all worked out. Nothing has happened." And he gruffly turned around to her and he said, "I don't know what you mean. You know, you're here today. Tomorrow there are going to be 50 women following you here to go after my players." And she said to him, "But there aren't 50 other women sports writers that even exist." And he said, "Oh, but there will be. They'll be after my players." So that was the attitude of that decade. So you can only imagine that when I actually got to the point of wanting the access to the locker room, that became a rather big deal in the eyes of them. If the press box and going on the field and eating with the sports writers were big deals before, this was a really big deal for them.
Well, the other thing that was interesting is that you were so young. And you probably didn't have the kind of self-confidence and polish that you might have later on in life.
I had none of it. I mean, if you want to talk about the notion of being a rookie, you can add to that that I, you know, Sports Illustrated was my journalism school. I had never worked on a paper. I was unlike most people who arrived at Sports Illustrated. Most of them came with a clip file that you'd need a wheelbarrow to carry upstairs. They'd been editors of major university papers, sports editors. They really knew what they were doing coming in. And I'd majored in art history at a women's college. I had no idea.
How old were you?
When I got the job, I was 22 or 23, I guess, just turned 23. So by the time I got the baseball beat when I was 25, you know, I had no idea how to cover a sport. I'd never been on a sideline, you know, covering a game. I'd never been to a baseball game where I'd had to cover it, where I'd had to actually go out, interview players, stand around the batting cage, understand the etiquette of what was happening. So, you know, as I'm writing my memoir now, what I'm doing is going back and reliving those early moments and recognizing that my first job was to really just watch and listen carefully to how the guys were doing it. Because you may remember, I mean, you certainly are of my era. Back then, the whole notion of success for women was based on whether you could do the job like the men did.
Yeah, right.
You weren't
yeah.
carving your own way.
Yeah.
You were trying to be a man as best you could in a man's world. And so I learned that what I should do is just really keep my mouth shut, hang out around what would become kind of the scrums of interviewers around a ball player or a manager. I would sit in the dugout and I'd really listen to how men asked the questions of the manager. I'd watch how the repartee took place after the first question was answered. I was really on a seminar of my own making for quite some time. And as I look back, there was a wisdom in that, because I really took my time to learn how the job was done before I ended up having to do it. And I had that time because the decision for me to be at the ballpark wasn't being made by the editor. I wasn't always on assignment. I was on my own assignment to learn. I went up because I had the pass now as a baseball reporter to be there. And so I really took advantage of the idea of being there to learn how to be there for when it came possible for me to actually be assigned to be a reporter covering the game, because my primary job was to fact check the stories that the writers did. That was my prime job. So this was extracurricular on my part. I wasn't paid overtime. I did my own transportation, which was, you know, a subway up and then a subway home by myself at midnight. There was no, you know, cab I could call and get reimbursed. As I say, no payment for that time. So I'd work from in the day from maybe 9 to 5 or so, and then I'd be on the subway up to the ball game and home at midnight. Mm-hmm. And that was my life.
Let's talk a little bit about the language. Those of us who sort of grew up outside of sports, it's hard to even understand what sports writers are talking about. And I like the way you had that as an entree.
Yeah, I'd been very fortunate in my childhood to have two parents, both of whom had grown up loving sports. My father grew up in the Midwest, so he was really attracted to college football. He'd gone to the University of Iowa and as a graduate student, and both my parents were out there then. They were married, and they were very much into kind of the football spirit of that Iowa brings out in you. But my mother always carried a passion for her baseball experience growing up near Boston, and particularly the Red Sox in Fenway Park. So I was introduced very early to football by my father, as well as some basketball. He would take us in the winter to some of the university basketball games where he taught. And my mother, just to baseball, both physically taken to Fenway Park on very special excursions, but more listening on the radio and listening on TV with her and just watching her passion about it. And I'll just share with you that, you know, one of the things you do when you're writing a memoir is you try to go back and find all of the documents you can. And I discovered a box that she had kept from when I was born. You know, maybe I was fortunate. I was her first of five children, so she kept more things. But there's a letter from my grandfather written to my mother 4 days after I'm born. It's about page and a half type letter, and you go through maybe the first two paragraphs, which were, it's so exciting that Melissa's born. Of course, he spells my name wrong and all these things, and it's all of that, Jeannie, I hope you're doing well, because she was in Iowa, he was in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And you get to the third paragraph, and it begins about the doubleheader that had just been played between the Yankees and the Red Sox in Fenway Park, and how he was thinking of his Jeannie, who used to go with him to these games. And so he proceeds to tell her about everything that's happened in the game. Mm-hmm. And it's written in a very colloquial kind of, well, and then, you know, he boomed those homers out, and we beat those Yankees, and blah, blah, blah. And the Red Sox happened to be in first place at the time. So I feel like from birth, you know, this was kind of a birthright that I sort of had to generationally kind of pick up the baton of this. And it was effortless to do so because my mother had such a great love for it. Mm. That early on I learned how to score baseball games. I learned how to, you know what the penalties were and what the four downs were in football. And as you say, along with that, I came to be able to understand how to talk about sports mm-hmm. with the guys. And so I always had a fluidness to that conversation. It was never something where I felt out of place if sports was the topic. So that really paid off in ways that are just innumerable. You can't even begin to say what a gift that is if you end up being a sports writer, yeah. particularly a woman. Because the after games were very important to me to start building trust and relationships with some of the male reporters and have them understand that I could tell the stories in the way they did. I could recite the stats. Baseball is a game of history that's recorded in statistics, and it also lives in the anecdotes. You have to know about Willie Mays' miraculous catch in the center field. You have to know these things. You have to know about Bucky Dent's, you know, home run. You have to know about Carlton Fisk barely getting the home run around the pole to put us into the Game 7 of the 1975 World Series. I mean, these things are just the lore of baseball. And if you don't know the stories, if you don't know the names, you're going to feel very out of it when you sit around a table afterwards and kind of just shoot the breeze. Yeah. But I could do that, and I had a fascination with them. And so another thing I was doing, aside from watching how they did interviews, is I was sort of reading up and taking in and learning and being able to tell the stories of baseball and participate in that way, because that was equally important to kind of fitting in.
I am reminded of my father played baseball when he died. My father's coach came to the memorial ceremony and said to my son what a wonderful grandfather he had. And it was, they, you know, stuck together during the years.
Yeah.
So I was sort of on the periphery of that also.
Yeah, no, it's a very tight tribe, and I understood it. And I said this to someone last night. We were talking about the experience of actually going into a locker room if you're a woman, and we were talking about sort of the behavior that can happen inside of it. And I was saying that from the very beginning, you know, being around even just the ballpark to start with and then thinking about the kind of way that one would be treated inside a locker room, I said I understood that I was coming into their territory. It wasn't my territory. It was theirs. And I clearly understood that when I went into a locker room, I could not expect their behavior or their ways of behaving and acting and interacting with each other was going to conform to a style or a tone or even a kind of pleasurable experience for me, you know, because there's ribbing and joking and playing tricks and playing games on each other. It's part of their team. It's part of what, you know, kind of brings them together within that area. So I always said to myself that I would know when they'd crossed a red line. Of course, that was the era where we didn't even have a word for sexual harassment. You might remember that word really only developed as a sort of piece of our consciousness, really, when Anita Hill, you know, brought it to our attention. And that would be 14 years away, you know, for me. But I did have a sense that if there was a line that was crossed, I would know it and I would do something about it. But up to that line, I just had to deal, you know, with what was their place, their environment. I was coming into it.
Let's disabuse any listeners of the notion that it had to deal with nudity or with undressing, with the players undressing, because that wasn't the issue.
No, it wasn't the issue. I mean, historically, what we've talked about before is the exclusion of women from all of these places, which clearly men are not naked while they're doing batting practice. The sports writers are not naked while they're in the press box. None of these places had to do with nudity, but they all had to do with exclusion of women. And the locker room was the same way. I mean, it was a false narrative that was portrayed that you were going to walk into a locker room and this was a private space for men in which there was had to be nudity. There did not have to be. The shower area was off limits to every reporter, men, women. In other words, it was equally off limits to everyone. So no player had to ever be in a situation where they were naked. Now, was that to say that no player would be or choose to be as a way to possibly try to embarrass or insult, you know, a woman who was trying to do an interview? No, I mean, that happened all the time, and that was kind of their quote, playfulness or their meanness. Yeah. That was their choice. It wasn't something that was obligatory. And I do want to also say that the locker room is not only a place where interviews happen after the game. That's the sort of public perception that players, you know, are in the state of changing from their uniforms to their street dress. I was also excluded from the locker room during, say, a 45-minute period in which most interviews for most stories actually take place, and that is between the time that a team takes batting practice and a game begins. The locker room was totally open to men reporters during that time. That's when they really gathered their notes and did their long interviews. And no player ever changed out of a uniform. No player showered. That was a time where everyone just kind of hung out, sat around, and that was the time that they were expecting that they would talk with media. So I wasn't there either. So when someone looks at this and says, well, wait a minute, you know, this is a situation where you don't belong in there because they're going to be nude and that would be improper, et cetera, which was the narrative of the time. That was totally a misguided narrative because there was this whole period that I was excluded where none of that was a factor. So it was just a bogus thing, but it was a very powerful and very successful argument. It reminds me a little bit of sort of the sort of Trumpian way of thinking about things today. You choose on what most people fear the most, you know, which is that there may be this intersection of clothed women and naked men and all of that, what happens with that. And so you pick out the thing that people fear most, and so then you characterize the person who wants that to happen as the one who's being immoral or the kind of bad person in it. Mm-hmm. And that was really, you know, I think about it now, that was the strategy that baseball used. It was the one that a lot of the sports writers picked up on as sort of their talking points. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's talk about how you got in, things were made okay, and then everything changed.
How did everything change? Well, yes. I mean, we went to court. We went into the Southern District Court of Manhattan, Lower Manhattan, and we had a hearing before a judge, Judge Constance Baker Motley. She heard both sides. She actually asked both sides after the hearing to try to go back one more time and resolve this so that they could spare her from having to make a, you know, decision in it. And they ended up not being able to do that. I'm not sure that we ever actually met as different sides because it was pretty clear to all of us that there was no resolution outside the court deciding. And so about a year after I had been banned from the clubhouses by the commissioner, Judge Motley wrote an opinion in which she gave me equal access. Now, it's very important to think about this. She gave me equal access. That did not mean that she was telling baseball, you have to let women in the locker room. They had a choice. If they wanted to take all the reporters out of the locker room and do the interviews somewhere else, that was their choice. They could choose how to do it however they wanted, and she kept emphasizing this to them. You know, you have a choice. You can figure it out, but it has to be equal. Whatever you decide just has to be the same for men and women. And she had been involved with Thurgood Marshall for many, many years through the NAACP Legal and Education Fund, and in fact had written the brief in Brown versus Board of Education. So she knew very well that a separate but equal policy was not an equal policy, mm-hmm. equal access. So her decision reflected that based on the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause.
And then everything changed after that decision?
Well, I guess everything changed in the sense that women were on an equal playing field.
But were you satisfied?
I was satisfied with the direction that we were headed 40 years ago. Am I satisfied that the speed of cultural change around this has been adequate? Absolutely not. I mean, if you'd asked me 40 years ago to look in the looking glass ahead, first of all, I wouldn't have been able to do it because I'd only lived 26 years. And the idea of asking me to look ahead longer than I'd already lived, I don't think I could have done it. But as I look back and ask myself that question, no, I mean, the pace just seems much too slow to me to have, you know, women just be given an equal shot at being able to be engaged in the business of sports media and sports reporting. That said, within the last two or three years, for whatever reason, we are now, for the first time in those four decades, seeing women coming into the broadcast booth, being much more taken off the sidelines where they've been sort of held captive for a long time. And now you find them in the broadcast booth. You find women, and again, you know, one to a sport at this point, you know, in terms of network TV. But you do find it in Major League Baseball with Jessica Mendoza. You find it in basketball with Doris Burke. You find it, you know, in baseball again with Susan Waldman, who does color commentary, 14th year of doing it for the Yankees. And you're finding it now in football, both on the college and the pro level. And the other day, literally for the first time, a woman did a play-by-play broadcast of the NBA Wizards game. That's a first. I mean, where you have a woman actually doing the play-by-play, that's kind of been that sacred territory, you know, that just has not been crossed. And that's now, for the first time, opening up. On the downer side, you do not see the coverage of women's sports that you should be seeing that's at all commensurate with the skill level, the talent, and the winningness of women athletes, either representing the U.S. or in the leagues that are there. I mean, when you have less than 5% of sports broadcasting in this country being women's games, we are still at a point that's just way, way below where I would have expected we would be at this point, or should be. Okay. So that's that. And then the other side that's not a good report is that you still have a very small representation of women in the newsrooms, in the sports department newsrooms, with the exception of, for example, a paper like the Washington Post, in which you not only have the four major leagues being covered by lead reporters being women, but you have the lead woman columnist probably in the country, Sally Jenkins. So you have five or six women there prominent on the Washington Post sports page. But that is that the reason I'm bringing it up is because it's just such an exception to the general rule.
Okay. When can we see your book? When can we look to see it?
Okay, I'm a slow writer. I have, in fact, having just gone through the 40th anniversary of this, of my judge's decision about 2 weeks ago, I was really out on the road, did a lot of interviews, and what I discovered is that the book I have been writing for the past, say, 8 months to a year is not the book that I should be writing. And that's been a really interesting part of this new journey, this 40th anniversary. I've realized that the book that I should be writing for today's readers is a different one. And so I've scrapped my entire book, and I'm starting anew. So as I do this interview, I'm just 2 weeks into writing a different book. And so I don't know, maybe I'll be finished in a year, maybe it'll be a year and a half. But I hope you'll come back and we can talk about it once it's out.
Okay.
Because I'm really excited about this new approach. So
okay.
I'm up again for this.
Thank you for sharing the development of your thoughts with us.
Well, thank you for letting me talk on this topic. It's one that is still a big part of my life. And it's a part of my life that I hold dear and that I write about it, the opportunities that come along. I've recently done a couple of essays. And one of them, I looked at the extraordinary life of my judge, Constance Baker Motley, and also of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, two women who I believe I rest on their shoulders in terms of the legal precedents that they had set to enable my case to be decided as it was. Mm. So I'm hoping that I can continue to tell their stories and my story and, you know, engage in using this history as a way for us to think about where we are today and where we can be.
Okay. Thank you.